The NFL theme song on Fox gets us started on the first segment of our show today, and we're playing a little Thursday morning quarterback here as we look at the Packers 2024 season and look ahead a little bit to 2025. Larry Mueller here with my guest, back with us, Pete Doherty. Pete's a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's covered the Packers since 1993 and knows a whole lot about the Packers. And, of course, we want to hear from you. What were some of your maybe favorite moments from the season? What moments made you scream in frustration at your TV? What do you think the Packers should do this offseason? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Pete Doherty, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Tell you what, overall, we'll start with that. Overall, would you say the 2024 Packers season was successful, disappointing, little of both?
Yes, definitely. Definitely all those things. You know, it's funny. We have a weekly question that somebody on our staff, you know, asks all the Packers reporters to answer, you know, in a paragraph, basically. And after the season, it was, what grade would you give the Packers? I gave them a C+. Could be probably talked into giving them a C. Expectations were just so high with how well they played in the playoffs last year. I think that colored a lot of things. I know I went in thinking they'd go 11-6. They ended up going 11-6, but I didn't see 11-6 and descending at the end of the season. I was thinking more likely they'd be ascending at the end of the season. And so that's the reason that the season was a disappointment. You know, there are going to be ups and downs every NFL season. It's a rough business. Player performance is up and down, even for the good teams. There's a lot of ups and downs, the best teams even. But the bad finish, the really poor offense for the last month of the season, the poor passing game, that really took a lot of luster off of a decent season. 11-6 is a pretty decent season.
Jerry emailed. Jerry says he's disappointed with Jordan Love's performance this season. He says it was a tragic mistake to give him $50 million a year based on one season's performance. Love needs to step up his game. He threw way too many interceptions. One obvious reason they weren't able to compete in the division or the playoffs.
He definitely, I agree completely. The biggest thing that can happen for the Packers is for Love to play better next season. That alone will get them a lot of the way to where they're looking to go. He threw way too many interceptions the first half of the season. I think he had 10 in the first 9 games, and he only played basically 6.5 of those games. He only threw one the rest of the regular season and then had a couple in that last playoff game. Still for me too early to say that they made a mistake in paying him. At the time, I for sure would have done it. There are all sorts of good reasons for doing it. Yes, it could end up, it was risky, and it could end up, you know, being a mistake because, you know, if Love's performance doesn't pick up. But there would have been big downside to it, too. I was talking with Mike Holmgren, the former Packers coach, who's now he's a finalist for the Hall of Fame this year. And we were talking about quarterbacks, and he said it really takes until their third season as a starter before you know what you have. And next season, 2025, will be Jordan Love's third season as a starter. This is the season they need to start reaping the rewards of the ups and downs. I'm still not sure this season how much the knee and groin injuries, and especially the knee, affected his play. He looked pretty healthy the second half of the season. I still think he looked just a half step slow on his first couple steps when he tried to leave the pocket, and I wonder if he also had just confidence issues in that knee. It's something that won't heal completely till the off season. You know, I'm not paid to make excuses for him, but we need to be realistic about these things also. And so I do wonder if that was an issue, and we will find out next season. But regardless of whether it was or not, you know, he was an inexperienced quarterback play as far as playing time in the NFL. Now he's had two full seasons. He'll have an off season to digest everything, to work on the things he needs to, all of that. And the Packers need to see the rewards starting next season for all the ups and downs they go through. If you look at Favre and Rodgers, in their sixth season, in their fifth season, they started turning the corner as a player, and in their sixth season, that's when they hit pay dirt, became really good players. So that's when the Packers won Super Bowls in the sixth season for both of those guys. Not saying Love has to win the Super Bowl this year to be a, you know, 25 to be a success, but his play definitely needs to show real improvement and sophistication.
Yeah. And, you know, you think about it, he was throwing to some young guys. I think it was the second season in a row the Packers were the youngest, had the youngest NFL roster. You look at that as a problem, or could it be a plus? Maybe we don't have the veteran leadership that we need to have.
I think it's more a plus than a problem because it's such a young man's game. And these guys have played a lot now. So even they're going to be young next season in terms of age.
Yeah.
But they won't be young. They won't be young as far as playing experience goes. And one of the biggest one of the biggest position disappointments this year was receiver. After the way those guys finished last year, really thought they would take a nice jump this season. Did not happen. I think they were, depending on, you know, which statistical service you go to, they were about second in the league in drops. And while Love is definitely deserves, you know, his share of responsibility for how the offense slipped at the end of the season, you know, the drops at receiver were a significant issue also.
Yeah. And in some ways, I think Coach LaFleur seemed to be making a nod toward veteran leadership when he said that our quarterback had to kind of become more vocal. I think he said at the end, didn't he, that Love needed to become more vocal and take more charge than he has.
He did. Love has a low key guy. You know, he's not a big personality. He's not a big extrovert. But you know, the quarterback position is just, you know, baked into that position that you're the leader. And so, you know, there is much of it is by example and performance, but there still is, you know, also the overt leadership, the, you know, saying things at the right time, the getting on guys occasionally, but also, you know, having them like you so they want to play for you. And so, yeah, he's, you know, he's not a natural that, like Favre was just a big, big personality and an outgoing guy. Yeah. That was easy. That was who he was. Love is not that kind of guy, and he shouldn't try to be. But, you know, he's starting to build up some experience now. So, yeah, that was the thing. The LaFleur answered that. The question was, what's he need to do? What's he need to work on this offseason? And LaFleur talked far less about, you know, technical quarterback things, you know, like footwork. And, you know, basically said the main thing was just to become a little more of an outgoing, overt leader.
Yeah. Well, injuries certainly played a role this season, although I don't think we suffered as much as perhaps the Lions, for example, did. But I think it was a big factor. Christian Watson likely was a big factor.
Yeah. You know, it's funny with injuries, so much of it, it's not how many you lose, it's who you lose.
Yeah.
You think back to 2010, you know, I'm sure you remember then when they won the Super Bowl that year. They had their injured list was, I think it was the biggest I've been covering since 93. And I think their injured reserve list was the longest of all my time covering. It was upwards of 20 guys, I think. It was in the upper teens for sure. But they didn't lose any guys that they couldn't afford to lose. The positions where they lost pretty good players, they had just as good, if not better, to replace them. This year, they really, if you look at their injury totals, it wasn't bad at all because everybody in this league, that's the nature of this game, is everybody has a lot of injuries. And Detroit had a ton. I think what ended up catching up, losing Hutchinson eventually caught up with them. He's as good a defensive player as there is in the league, and that eventually is probably going to bite you, and I thought it, you know, finally did in the playoffs. But the Packers, they really didn't get hit that hard, except that their quarterback got hurt, and he played through it, and they won the two games without him. But I do wonder if it affected his performance later in the year, at least somewhat. And then you're right, Watson is the one guy. I'm not saying he was their best receiver, because that's probably Jaden Reed. But Watson's combination of size and speed, they just can't replace that. And that affects the way defenses play, because they have to honor him, you know, going deep on any given play. So that opens things up for other people. So that injury did take a chunk out of their offense. And, you know, he's not – I mean, he won't be back till mid-November next year. So they're basically won't have him till late, and he probably won't be the same guy until, you know, the 2026. So that's a position and a role and a talent that they have to somehow replace this offseason.
Yeah, he was so fast. Or is, I guess, when he's healthy, he has to draw cover. You know, you have to know when he's in there if you're the opposing team. And that creates, you know, opportunities for guys like maybe Reed or somebody else receiving the ball.
It does. And, you know, I was just watching, one of my colleagues is going through every game and grading all the players, and he takes a whole week to do that, and he sends me plays, and he sent me a play from the Minnesota game in Minnesota where they gave up like a 40-yard touchdown pass, the Packers did, and it was the Justin Jefferson effect. Jefferson runs a crossing route underneath, and the safety comes up, and they throw over the safety's head for the touchdown. And now Christian Watson's not Justin Jefferson, don't mean to suggest that for a second. But that's the kind of thing we're talking about is, you know, when one player draws extra coverage, that opens things up for other guys. And I don't know how the Packers are going to do it. Maybe they'll try to do it in free agency. Maybe they'll use a really high draft pick on a receiver. But they've got to do something to help Love there just to get a more dynamic presence into their receiving core if they can.
Yeah. Dobbs? What'd you think of his performance this year, Romeo Dobbs?
Yeah, okay. You know, he's got hurt a couple times, and that, you know, that issue he had in the middle of the season where he just seemed to be really upset about his role and he didn't show up for practice. I mean, that's just unthinkable in this league. Not unthinkable because, I mean, every once in a while, a couple times a year, it seems to happen around the league. But it's really damaging to the player's career, damaging to the locker room. And, you know, that did nothing to help their season. He came back, his teammates accepted him from what I could tell. And he's a good possession receiver. But the Packers have, you know, they basically have a roster, a receiving core full of receivers who are, you know, if you're going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they've got a bunch of maybe mid twos to fours in their receiving core, and they don't have a guy who scares defenses and who changes the way they play and who can make plays even when they're double covered. These guys are hard to come by, but it sure helps an offense if you have one of them. And I think that's one of the reasons why receiver, I don't think it's their greatest need, but it's, you know, it's amongst their top three, I would say.
Yeah. Pete Doherty, our guest today, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. It was great to have Pete come by. He's spent a lot of time with the Packers and knows a whole lot about football and the Packers. You can join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk about the Green Bay Packers with our guest Pete Doherty, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. Join in, 800-642-1234. 1234 email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take some calls. Jonah in Green Bay, we'll go to you now. Jonah, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. I got a question about the Packers defense. So I haven't been following football all that long, like maybe just since the beginning of the pandemic, like 4 or 5 years or so. It feels like there's not ever any consistency with the Packers defense. I'm wondering, has it always been this way? Has it always been they're either like really on top of things in one play, or they're really just scrambling around like a bunch of cartoon characters in the next? Like, that's what it feels like.
Yeah. Jonah, thanks for calling. Pete, what do you think?
Yeah, well, that's a really big question and hard to answer in a nutshell, but a couple things. The NFL is an offensive, all the rules are geared for offense, so it's, playing defense just keeps getting harder. It's gotten harder and harder year after year over the last 50 years. And this year, for instance, there were no great defenses. There were good defenses, but nothing even close to great anywhere in the league. The Packers have been, they were a pretty good defensive team when they won the Super Bowl in 2010. I think they were top three in scoring that year in fewest points allowed. And they've had 1 or 2 years since then where they've been pretty good, but that's it. To have a really good defense, you need, Dom Capers, their former defensive coordinator, always said you need three difference makers. And those guys can be hard to find, especially when you're picking later in the draft and you got to hit on some picks. And they really haven't, they've been low on the difference maker scale since Clay Matthews started, his play started declining because of age and injuries. And I thought Rashawn Gary might be headed that way a few years ago. He had a really big second half of, I think it was his third season in the league, but then he tore his ACL, came back, played pretty well. They paid him. And he's just been a little above average since then. They do seem to have drafted a difference maker this year in Edgerrin Cooper. Like, they may have a real star there finally. But they really could use at least one more. That's why I'm an advocate. Generally not big on trading for guys, and these huge free agent moves often backfire and end up being a waste of money. And this isn't fantasy football like Ted Thompson used to say, but if they could trade, if the Raiders are willing to trade Max Crosby because they want draft picks because they're rebuilding, I would look really hard at trading for Max Crosby. He's just young enough still where they could probably get 3 really good years out of him, and that would give them 2 difference makers. One is a pass rusher, which is huge. That could make a big difference for their defense. I'll be really curious to see how that happens or see what happens there and if they can do something like that this offseason. But your overall observation is right. I mean, they've been a very average or worse defense for most of the last 15 years, and they were actually better this year. They improved on their new defensive coordinator, Jeff Hafley. I think they were 6th in fewest points allowed. Their run defense was really good. But they still did have trouble getting stops when you absolutely had them in a league where a lot of teams have trouble with that. And again, pass rusher, pass rusher, pass rusher. That's what helps you get those stops when you got to have them.
Yeah, I thought Hafley did a pretty good job. He had some injuries there, too, some key injuries. And Jair Alexander comes. I mean, he only played a third of the games.
I apologize for interrupting, but when we talk about the difference makers, that actually was – Alexander is their most talented defensive player, but in the last 4 years, I think he's missed like, I think it's about half the games, and he's getting older, so these injuries are going to accumulate, and I just have to think the Packers are going to move on from him this offseason because you just can't pay a guy that much money and have him unavailable. But not when you have only one key difference maker and then he hardly plays, You know, your margin for error goes way down. So they do have, I think they've got a lot of talent, both sides of the ball. They actually have okay talent, but they still have some, a couple big moves that they need to make and hit on this offseason if they want to be a real contender next year.
Let's go to Jim in Verona next. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Pete. I'm curious what you think of the possibility of the Packers picking up our old friend Davante Adams.
Yeah, that's a big question floating around. This is one of those where if I'm the Packers, I don't think I'm interested. He's 32. He was a great player. He's still very good, but the decline for him could start kicking in at any time. This is about the age with even the best receivers where it starts kicking in. If I'm, and he's still going to cost a fair amount of money. If I'm the Packers, I don't think I'm interested in bringing him back. It would be nice to have a guy with his experience to share what he's learned about playing receiver with these younger guys. But if they add a receiver to this offseason, they're going to want to get those young guys on the field to get them, because they have upside and they'll improve. So if I'm the Packers, I pass on Davante Adams. The history of Brian Gutekunst, to me, suggests that he'll pass, but you never know on any given player. It's just, we were talking earlier about being a young team, Larry, and this is a young man's game. And, man, a receiver getting up to 32, he could have a really nice season next year, but the odds are just as good that the injury problems will start kicking in and a little bit of decline. And you just got to move on from things. And he's 32 is just a little too old for me, unless they could get him at a really cheap price. And I find it hard to believe that he'll play for anybody for a low price tag.
Jim, thank you for calling. Let's take a call from Rich in DeForest. Hi, Rich.
Hi, guys. I've been watching for years and years and years. I love the NFL, but I can't make heads or tails of cap money. So could Pete go through it? Go ahead quickly. Let's say I'm a great defensive back. You signed me to a contract of $20 million, but you're going to give me a signing bonus of 10. Okay, how does that affect the cap money? And what about dead money? I've heard that too. I don't know where that comes from. And guaranteed contracts. So if you could do that very simply for a guy to understand. Thank you.
All right. Rich, thanks a lot for calling. There's probably a lot of people that have that question, Pete.
Yeah. It's. I hope I can explain this succinctly. I'll give it a shot. So the example you bring up, 5-year deal, $20 million, $10 million bonus. So you get the $10 million right when you sign the contract. Now that, because it's a signing bonus, is prorated over the 5 years. For cap purposes, that $10 million counts $2 million against the cap each year of that contract. So your cap number starts out with the first year will be $2 million because of the signing bonus proration. And then whatever they make the base salary that first year is the rest of the cap number. So let's say they pay you that $10 million bonus, but then they only pay you $1 million salary. So you're getting $11 million in cash, a lot of money. But you'll only count $2 million from the signing bonus and $1 million base salary. So your cap number is only $3 million. Now let's say after two seasons, things have gone really badly and they decide to cut you. What happens in that season then is the dead money you're talking about, because the $2 million in years 3, 4, and 5 still have to count against your cap because they paid you that money. So all that money accelerates into year 3, so that you'll count $6 million on the cap if they cut you after 2 years, even though you're no longer on the team. I don't know if that covered, did that cover
guaranteed,
the whole thing?
Guaranteed, he said something about guaranteed money.
Oh, and guaranteed money is just, they can, the signing bonus is guaranteed. They can't take that money back, or just under very specific circumstances can they get that money back. So that's guaranteed money. And they can guarantee, like with quarterbacks especially, they'll guarantee money through the first 2 or 3 years of the contract. And as long as you show up and play football, you get that money. If you get hurt, you still get it. But you do have to show up for work, but that money is yours no matter what. And so when you're evaluating a contract a guy signed, the number that always gets reported is the average, and that's important. But really the most important thing is the guaranteed money, because that's the money the guy's going to get no matter what, as long as he shows up for work.
And I think there's plenty of cap space for the Packers going into, I think, wasn't it $50 million or something like that?
It is. Now, and a big chunk of that is still going to be eaten up by costs that haven't shown up yet. You know, there's they have restricted free agents that they have to tender. They've got a draft class that they'll have to pay. There are several built-in expenses not counted on that. But even if you count all that, they still have, I think it's like $25 or $26 or $27 million in cap space, which is a lot, because as we just talked about, when you for the proration, you can sign a guy to a really big contract and keep his cap number low for the first year or two. So they basically have enough money where they can be very liberal if they want to in spending and free agency or trading for an expensive player. They can do all those things. Money will not be a limitation to what they do in this offseason. The limitation will be whether they can get the guys that they want, that they think are worth that kind of money.
Yeah. And Gutekunst he didn't do a great job on the first round picks. He did on second, I think, with Edgerton James and a couple of other guys too. I think Evan Williams comes to mind. He did some things over the course of the year, but his free agent pickups, those were really good. Xavier McKinney and Josh Jacobs as running back. I was just thinking about those picks. I think were pretty good ones.
Yeah, I think you can say he hit home runs on both of those. You know, he's spent big in free agency twice. He did it back in, 19, when he signed Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith and Adrian Amos and an offensive lineman whose name is escaping my mind right now. But, you know, he did pretty well with those signings. The Smiths especially produced really well for several years for the Packers. And then this year he spent big again. In between... The pandemic hurt a lot of teams' cap, and that hurt the Packers really bad. Plus, Aaron Rodgers' contract and Bakhtiari's, they were just mortgaging contracts just to get under the cap, and they couldn't do much in free agency. The two guys they signed this past season were home runs. The problem that I'm seeing, looking just through the prospective free agents this offseason, is, and their great needs are, pass rusher, cornerback, and receiver. I'm not seeing any pass rushers or cornerbacks who are those positions equivalents of a Josh Jacobs or Xavier McKinney. It's just they're just not there. So I don't know that they're going to be able to make any big signings there that'll make that big a difference. They may have to just sign several guys and hope, you know, one or two of them pans out. T. Higgins is available at receiver. I don't know if they would spend the money it'll take to get a receiver, and maybe Cincinnati will sign him before free agency, but that's one guy who's a possibility at that position. But at least at first glance, I'm not seeing the availability of a player such as the two that they signed this past season. So that's why I'm wondering if the trade route might be the way that they have to go.
Yeah. Jim emailed us, and you mentioned Pat. We were talking about pass rush a bit, and he said, aside from a few games, the defensive pass rush was mediocre. And Jim is wondering, was it the scheme? Was it the personnel? What needs to be done?
Yeah, that's an age old question. They did fire their defensive line coach. That suggests that LaFleur thinks that was at least, LaFleur and Halfley think that was part of the problem, it probably was. You just didn't see the kind of improvement that you would expect, like from Lucas Van Ness, their first round pick 2 years ago. He did not make a big jump this year. So you wonder if there was a coaching disconnect there. The scheme should be good for a pass rush. I mean, you know, they went from where the outside linebackers slash defensive ends stand up to where they put their hand on the ground. And that theoretically putting your hand on the ground is a better rushing position because you're coming out of the sprinter's blocks. But the rush was not – the four-man rush was not good enough this year. I mean, mediocre is the best you can say about it. So, you know, we will find out. It was a combination of the talent and the coaching, I'm sure. But the Packers, you know, LaFleur and Halfley must think the coaching was part of it because they're making a change at that position.
Yeah. Pete Doherty, our guest, questions for him as we talk Packers. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Questions for Pete, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Got an email from Orly. His comment is, what about adding a William Henderson or John Coons type halfback? Great blockers, but also a threat for the outlook pass. Not them in particular, but somebody like them.
Yeah, yeah. So they had a fullback in camp, but they ended up cutting him, and they basically use tight ends to some degree in that kind of role. Not many teams have fullbacks, but a handful do, and they, you know, Juszczyk at San Francisco has been a really good player. I don't know that if the Packers have any plans to look in the draft this year for somebody like that. But they, you know, a lot of teams use a tight end in a quasi fullback type role. It just depends on the body type you're looking for. They appear to be open to keeping a fullback. I think if you look at the rosters around the league, I would guess without having done it, we're at a point, I mean, the position's almost extinct. I would guess there's 10 or fewer teams that have a fullback on the roster now. But, you know, LaFleur runs the Shanahan offense, and Shanahan has one out in San Francisco, and they did have one in camp. So it appears to be something they're open to. The hard part apparently is finding the right guy who can do both of those things you talk about, because he's got to both be a blocker and, you know, a guy who's pretty good at getting out and catching the ball and running with it afterwards.
Let's take another call. Yordis in Colfax, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was wondering if you could compare the Washington Commanders' kind of startling rise and kind of the joyful play that has gotten them far in the playoffs, like the Packers last year. The Packers were young. They were exciting. Everything was just clicking at the right time. And that maybe this year teams studied the Packers a lot more carefully, weren't going to be surprised by them. And then, of course, all the injuries affected them. But just that the Commanders kind of remind me of the Packers last year.
Hmm.
I agree completely. I was thinking the exact same thing watching the Washington game over the weekend. I don't know if you saw, but Sean Payton, the coach of the Broncos, after they clinched their playoff berth in the final game of the season, and they had a real young team with a rookie quarterback, and his locker room, all the players gathered around him, he said, "Let me tell you something, remember this, young and hungry is dangerous." And he said it like three times. And that's what the Packers were in 2024, and that's what the Washington looked like this year. Young, naive in a good way, and hungry, and just out to prove themselves and just playing. And I've got the exact same vibe that you did. And one other thing I would add to this season with the Packers is I don't think they handled the increased expectations well enough, because Washington will face this next year now. They're riding a great crest, and it's great. And who knows, it might even take into a Super Bowl win. But next year, no matter how far, what happens from here on out, they've already set a really high bar for next season. And guys start thinking they arrived, and you lose that little bit of hunger that Sean Payton was talking about. That can make all the difference in the world. And I think the Packers, They lost that. They didn't have that young and hungry vibe this year, even though they were young. And, you know, I don't think they handled that the greatest. The only upside to their really disappointing end of the season is maybe that stirs the hunger. And if some of these guys thought they'd arrive, maybe they no longer think that, and that the team will be a little hungrier again next season. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking the exact same thing watching Washington play this weekend.
Yep, they were a lot of fun to watch. I saw a few of their games. They were a lot of fun to watch. And they did have that excitement. It was just great to watch them. It's fun.
Yeah, that quarterback, you know, whatever ups and downs he had, it seems like whenever he got the ball at the end of the game, if they needed a score, he got it for them.
Yeah, very, very good. Yurtis, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dennis in Wisconsin Rapids. We'll go to you. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, morning. Hey, I'm just curious why they're not using Malik Willis. He's got good leadership qualities, runability, accurate passer. If they'd use him maybe 3 to 5 plays, why they're not implementing him, I do not understand.
He was one of Goody's pickups this last year, and probably we wouldn't have made the playoffs without him.
Yeah, 7th-round draft pick right after final cuts. That was a really good trade to have a backup quarterback. Basically, so he started 2 games and played the second half of 2 games, and they went 3-1 in those games. That's more than you can ask for from a backup quarterback. And, yeah, I'm with you all the way on that. You know, obviously the guy showed enough where they can trust the ball in his hands, and that running threat that you get, you know, the threat of the run pass option, the threat of the run option where he can either hand it off or keep it. There's all sorts of plays there for goal line and short yardage. I don't know why LaFleur didn't do it. You know, when you ask those kind of questions during the season, they won't answer them because they don't want to tip off opponents to what might or might not be coming. So they just give an ambiguous answer. So whenever he was asked about it, he'd say, yeah, it's something we're thinking about. They didn't do it until, I don't know if you noticed, in that last game against Chicago early in the game, the last regular season game, they had a player in the first quarter where Willis came in, Love stayed on the field and lined up at receiver, and Willis played quarterback, and he ran. He took the snap and had like a 3-yard run. And I wonder if they were they doing that just to give their next week playoff opponent something to think about, or were they checking to see how it worked, and was it something they actually were thinking of using in the playoffs? But the problem was Love hurt his arm and Willis hurt his thumb, so in that game. So I think whatever they were thinking there went out the window. This is something I definitely will be asking LaFleur about. We won't get a chance to talk to him until, I think maybe not until the owners meetings in late March, but that's definitely on the agenda for something to ask him about. And I don't know why you wouldn't do it. You know, that running, the threat of all those options of run, pass, handoff, or pitch it, you know, or having the quarterback keep it. There's a lot there for good short yardage and goal line plays. I'd be surprised if they don't do something like that, but you know, I don't know what LaFleur is thinking, so maybe we'll find out this offseason.
Dennis, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller here, my guest Pete Doherty, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin, here on the Wisconsin Public Radio News. Talking Packers today with our guest Pete Doherty of the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. Coming up, just to let you know, we'll be talking with the author of the book, The Living Great Lakes, Searching for the Heart of the Inland Seas, that at noon today in our next segment. But right now it's Packers, and you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. In an email, John wonders or thinks we didn't take full advantage of Jacobs. A great rushing attack should mean a strong play-action attack, but those things never seem to mesh. What do you think?
They didn't. And for the first half season, maybe. You know, I wondered if it was because Love was coming back from the injury, and if you put him under center, he's got to move more. And so I wondered if they put him in pistol and shotgun so he wouldn't have to move as much. And but as he got healthier, they would do more of the under center play action. LaFleur talked after the season about how their running game, it was demonstrably, I'm sure their numbers bear this out, was they ran the ball much better out of pistol and shotgun than they did under center. And so I don't doubt that that's true. I do wonder and want to ask him about later this offseason is, even if they did run the ball better from shotgun and pistol than under center, did it work to the detriment of their offense overall that they didn't do more from under center, because then their play action game would be better? And the reason it would be, in pistol and shotgun, when you're handing the ball off, the quarterback's facing the defense. So the defense can see the ball, and so they can see whether you're handing it off or not. When you're under center, you turn, your back's to the defense, the ball's hidden, so it's harder to tell if the running back is getting the ball or not. And that extra, you know, just half tick, half step can make all the difference in the world in coverage, you know, for a guy being on a receiver's hip as opposed to being, a half step off and there being enough of a window to make the throw. So I do wonder if, even though they ran it better from shotgun snaps, if the offense as a whole suffered. And I wonder if what their off-season study of themselves, the self-scouting, will prove there. My suspicion is that what you're pointing at there is probably right, and I wonder if we will see more under-center stuff next season.
James emailed us, what do you see for the future for A.J. Dillon?
I personally don't see any reason why they'd bring him back. They've got younger and better in Emmanuel Wilson and, Marshawn Lloyd, their third-round pick last year. I mean, he hardly played even in camp, and he got hurt right away when he played during the season, so we have hardly seen him. But they used a high pick on him, and he certainly flashes some speed and explosiveness. And then their other running back, I can't believe I'm Chris Brooks, is a big special teams guy, and they also used him a lot on third downs because they liked him as a pass protector. I think they've got younger, cheaper, and better, so I don't know why they would bring Dillon back. My strong suspicion is that they won't.
Lynn in Pewaukee emailed us, what about hiring Mike McCarthy?
Sounds like he's in the running for the Saints job. He's getting a second interview with them. Second interview means it's serious. There's a couple other guys who are getting second interviews too, but no, I don't. I've heard other people bring it up too. I do not see that happening. I mean, you know, what capacity would it be? There's no way that they're going to fire Matt LaFleur. So, and I don't think McCarthy would work for anybody in any other role than head coach. But I thought it would have been really fun if he had gotten the Bears job. That would have been interesting. But it sounds like he's got a real crack at the Saints job, so I'll be curious to see how that one goes.
You mentioned the Bears, and here we had an email from Luann from Green Bay. How concerned should we be about the Bears' new coach? Might they have a keeper this time?
They might. The one thing I'll say is, I mean, the guy seems very impressive. What he did with Detroit's offense. Now, he had a lot of talent to work with, but still, he pulled a lot of strings there, and that offense was very impressive. He looks like a creative play caller. I've heard, I know somebody who played for him with a different team who thought really highly of him. So he does seem good. The one caution is every year there's a hot coaching candidate, and it often turns out 3 years later that guy was no better than anybody else that was available that year. Not all the time. You know, Holmgren was the hot one, and he ended up being great. So this guy very well could be good. And on paper, he appears to be the most promising hire that they've made. And I would say, so I've been covering since 93, and I would say the most promising hire they've made in that time. And, you know, they need somebody to work with that quarterback because that guy's got talent. So yeah, I'm sure the Packers got to be concerned about that, but we don't know what running a team is so much different than coaching an offense, and you never know until the guy sits on that seat. And the converse is, how will this affect Detroit now? If he is really that good, maybe the Lions' offense suffers for it.
Yeah. Charlie emailed us. Charlie thinks they should put some serious time into developing Malik Willis more at quarterback. Every time he's in there, he makes good decisions, Charlie says. He apparently has a great arm, very athletic. Charlie also says they should look into trading Watson and Alexander if they can find another team that wants chronically injured players.
Yeah, well, nobody's going to trade for Alexander. He's that $17.5 million he's going to make in 2025. I just can't imagine any team trading for that contract. I can't imagine that happening. So I think the Packers are just going to have to cut him, unless he would take a big pay cut, and I don't think he would. And the Packers might be ready to move on anyway. And Watson, nobody's going to trade for an injured guy, but. It's part of the game, and even when some guys have injury histories in college and it carries on to the pros, some don't, but they get hurt in the NFL. Some guys just, their bodies are not made to withstand the rigors of the NFL, and it sure looks like that's two of them.
What about special teams? Brandon McManus was very important after going through, I forgot how many kickers, but wondering about did we have better special teams play this year?
The kicking and punting was really good this year, the first four games until they went to McManus. What was that? That was like four or five games in, I think. But yeah, he seemed to solve their kicking issues. Be stunned if they don't re-sign him in the offseason. He's a free agent, but I'll be stunned if they don't get something done with him. Because that last year and a half with the issues they were having, I mean, you just can't lose games by missing 43-yard field goals. It's just the margins are too thin in this league. Those things have to be close to automatic now. The coverage teams were okay. The return game wasn't very good. The first charge of special teams is the old medical oath, first do no harm. And so they were okay in that regard, I thought, but they're not a plus. They haven't been a plus for the team. Bisaccia, he's one of the highest paid special teams coaches. He's also an assistant head coach, so I think he helps LaFleur in other areas besides just special teams. I get the sense from talking to people over there that he's thought of really highly in the building, in the football side of the building. Sure sounds to me like there's no way they're making a change there. They have not become one of the best special teams in the league. I think they're better than they were for most of the previous, 15 years, maybe even more than that. But I would consider them mostly fulfilled the first do no harm. But then you do want to, they didn't force turnovers or things like that this year. It does help if your special teams can win you a game. I guess they did have the block kick against Chicago that won them that game. The block field goal at the end, the first go round.
Yeah. Otherwise we'd have lost every game in our division. Pete, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's always great to talk with you, and I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me, Larry, and I look forward to the next time.
Pete Doherty, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. Great to have him with us, and we will get him back, and we'll do it again. Coming up, talking the Great Lakes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It was more than 20 years ago, Jerry Dennis wrote the award-winning book, The Living Great Lakes, Searching for the Heart on the Inland Seas. It's a new edition out now. In it, he updates readers on the fate of the boat and crew with whom he sailed across the Great Lakes, talks a little about what's changed with the Great Lakes over that time period. He still lives near the shore of Lake Michigan. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Have you had adventures on or around the Great Lakes? Do you feel drawn to those massive bodies of water? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jerry Dennis, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Larry. Hello.
You know, I read your book 20 years ago. I'm pretty sure we did an interview 20 years ago. And here it is 20 years later. I read the book again. And it holds really, really well. I thought the way that you talk about the lakes, you weave the history of those areas around the lakes was so fascinating, and some really riveting shall we say, dangerous events that may have taken place either way a long time ago or right while you were sailing around the lakes. It just made it fascinating. So thanks for reissuing this and reintroducing me. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's talk about that trip for a minute. In 2020, you joined the crew of the schooner, the Malabar, to sail across. You did four of the five Great Lakes. What did you set out hoping to experience on that trip?
It's funny because it seems like yesterday. It's so vivid in my memory. I mean, it was such an amazing trip, and I learned so much. I had spent a couple of years circling the lakes, trying to find an entry into this book. I had hundreds of pages of notes and drafts, and just couldn't find my way into the heart of the lakes, which is why I chose that subtitle, until I met the captain and first mate of the Malabar and talked my way on board and served as a crew member to help sail this schooner through the lakes and ultimately to Bar Harbor, Maine, to deliver it to its new owners. But I wanted to see the lakes from the water. And a 19th century style schooner seemed ideal to me because those were the long haul truckers of the 19th century. And that was a big part of the commercial history of the lakes, took place on boats just like that. So I felt like it gave me a really unique perspective.
Hyo Nettle, the guy that you mentioned, he's a fascinating guy to me.
Oh, absolutely. He is something else, and he gave me many hours of pleasure sitting when we always chose the night shift to be on board, you know, be up on deck at the helm, and we'd sit next to each other, and he would talk for hours and hours and hours. He'd had an amazing, eventful life, and he was imaginative and funny and well spoken. We've stayed friends all these years.
That is really cool. He was kind of superstitious guy.
a lot of sailors, definitely.
Is that right? Didn't he have a horseshoe on the bow of the boat or something like that?
Yeah, he had it over his stateroom, and he wanted me to understand that you always had to have the horseshoe pointed up so that the luck stayed in the horseshoe. If you turned it upside down, and he would get really indignant about this, he'd say, some people turn it upside down, the luck pours out. And he just did not want anything like that to happen.
Doug in Madison has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Larry. I just wanted to talk about Washington Island, how amazing it is, and the salmon fishing that goes on around Washington and Rock Island. Lake Michigan's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been to Washington Island, and that's a fascinating place. But, yeah, the fishing in, around there and all through the northern, all through Lake Michigan in total is really good.
Yeah, it really is. I've been there, too, and I've enjoyed every minute that I've spent there, as a matter of fact, Washington Island, and done some fishing and caught some pretty nice fish on Lake Michigan as well with some charter boats. It was always a lot of fun to be on the water. The Great Lakes of Michigan and Superior, the Great Lakes contain nearly a fifth of the world's fresh water. And what are the shores? Something like 10,000 miles of shoreline?
Yeah, approximately.
How do you explain the size and importance of the Great Lakes to people?
That was a big part of the motivation for this and a couple of other books I've written. Any of us who live here have had the experience of having visitors who've never seen the lakes in our presence and watching how shocked they are that they can't be, you can't see across them, for instance, that they look like oceans. They are vast, and people who haven't seen them just have no idea. They see these see them on a map, and I get calls once in a while from people wanting to kayak across Lake Michigan and wondering where a good place to start from is. And I said, you don't want to do it, first of all, and they just don't understand. They are big lakes capable of huge waves.
You know, I just to go along with that, I think you mentioned in the book that Superior itself is 350 miles long. So I just went online this morning to check the length of Wisconsin. And the length of Wisconsin is 311 miles. So just to give a perspective of the size of it, I mean, here we are. It's longer than the state of Wisconsin by about 45 miles or so.
Yeah. 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 If you go from the western tip of Lake Superior to the eastern end of the St. Lawrence River, you're covering a quarter of the continent.
I get just absolutely amazing. Brad in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Brad.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just had an interesting story and experience that I got to experience with the Great Lakes. Quite a few years ago, I worked on an episode of Expedition Unknown on the Discovery Channel with Josh Gates.
Yeah.
He did an episode called, I believe it was called Ghost Ship of the Great Lakes. And I was a production assistant. We filmed mainly up around the UP, Manistique, Michigan. It was just one of the coolest experiences of my life. He actually went so far as to go down into the lake in a little yellow submarine that I got to watch being dropped into the lake. Yeah, it was pretty cool. He didn't actually end up finding the ghost ship, but we had a lot of fun filming that, and we went to a couple lighthouses and explored the history of this lost ship.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling. Well, you know, there were a lot of lost ships on the Great Lakes, and you get into it quite a bit. And November, of course, is probably the worst month.
Yeah, definitely.
Of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk on November 10th in 1975. And you tell a story. This is one of the more riveting stories that I can remember, packed into, I don't know, two or three pages I think this was in 1998, you attended a reunion of family members of those who perished on the Edmund Fitzgerald, and you went to that gathering, and you heard a guy by the name of John Lufkins, I believe, and he told the story. It didn't have to do with the Edmund Fitzgerald, but it did have to do with that night of him saving some people, a couple of people on the lake. And that was the most riveting story. The hair stood up in the back of my neck when I was reading what that man went through.
It took place at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that's the U.S. point that's closest to where the Fitzgerald went down. You can look out from the museum and see the general vicinity where she sank. And there were probably 40 people maybe in the audience, and you could have heard a pin drop as John Lufkins told his story about being out there in a 16-foot open boat with an outboard motor gathering gillnets, he and his 18-year-old brother-in-law. And that storm came up so fast that they didn't have a chance to get to shore and had to take harbor, find shelter on a little island in the offshore there that has clearly saved their lives. And then to go back out and rescue two other fishermen whose boat had capsized, and they were just hanging on to the hull in these 18, 20-foot waves. Crazy story.
Crazy, crazy story. I was just, I could hardly believe it. I think John Lufkin could hardly believe it either when he finally made it back to shore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he kept talking about it as a miracle that, you know, it was 20 years later, and he's still was almost shaking with emotion, remembering how close they came to drowning.
Yeah, he said he was he laid on the shore and thought of himself as the luckiest SOB in the world at that point, because he had no idea where he was, and he comes to the top of a 20-foot wave, and there's the island pop right in front of him, and he had no idea where it was. Oh my goodness me. Well, that was one of the many stories from your book that I really, really enjoyed. Well, you observed, I think it was, well, in 2003, the book came out, and climate change was well documented by that time, but causes, I think at the time, causes of climate change were still being debated. And we know a lot more about how climate change is impacting the Great Lakes today than we did back then.
Yeah, definitely. There wasn't a lot of empirical data at that time in 2003 about it. There was a lot of speculation, a lot of computer models predicting what would happen. But as it turns out, none of those computer models were severe enough. They were looking at much longer timelines to get where we are now with the water temperatures warmed as much as they are. That was a big part of the reason I wanted to do this new edition and update that, because I just barely touched on the subject in 2003.
Yeah, if you look at, I think we're losing an average of 14 or 15 days of winter every decade.
Yeah, that's crazy. There was some evidence of that happening shortly after the book came out. I live on Grand Traverse Bay in northern lower peninsula of Michigan, about at the tip of the Little Finger. And we happen to have been a harbor. The bay was a harbor for coal deliveries for over 100 years. And so there are records going back to around the 1880s of ice cover on the bays, because the boats couldn't come in if the bays were covered. So they would have to get reports. And it's really consistent for all those years up until about 1975. There were seven winters out of 10, the bays would freeze over and the boats couldn't come in. They'd have to plan ahead to get plenty to last the winter, because seven out of 10 times, you're not going to get in there. Since 1975, the number of frozen, you know, the bays freeze over more like once out of every 10 years. And we've been, I think we're at about 7 years now that we haven't had ice all the way across the bay. And that, you know, that's pretty distinctive change. And you can see it graphed. It's dramatic at 1975. And incidentally, the study that brought that to my attention was from some hydrologists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I believe. And they had also studied records from a lake in Japan that kept records for 500 years. And that was consistent with their records, and with a lake in Switzerland that had similar records for hundreds of years. All of the time, there was consistent freeze over until about 1975, and then the warming climate started kicking in, which is global, and it takes us across three continents.
And with the ice not there, the water is warming, and warming water has an impact on anything that's in the lake, I would guess.
It does. It does. It affects, spawning and life histories of most of the organisms in the lake. Plus, it opens them up to new invasive species from regions of the world that are warmer. That's a real concern in Lake Superior, because Superior so far has been able to stay clear of zebra mussels and quagga mussels and round gobies and spiny water flea that are, you know, in all the other lakes, because the cold water kept them out. But now Lake Superior is one of the fastest warming big lakes in the world, and it's just a matter of time before those invaders find a home there.
Jerry Dennis, our guest today, his book, it's the 20th anniversary edition with a new introduction. It's titled The Living Great Lakes, subtitled Searching for the Heart of the Inland Seas. You can join in, and I hope you do. Give us a call with your questions or comments or maybe your experiences to share on the Great Lakes. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Jerry Dennis about the 20th anniversary edition with a new introduction of his book, The Living Great Lakes. Again, questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a question from Paul in Toma. Paul, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. First thing, I want to kind of brag a little bit. I get to go live up there all next year by the town of Frieda. I don't know if he knows anything about that area, so I hope to get his book, sit back in a lazy chair and read it. But I guess I'm calling about, does he know anything about the monsters, the legends of the lake? I've heard of a few legends, where they may have originated from. I think there used to be pirates on the lake, more modern day pirates, but anything that might be kind of historical in that respect.
Okay. Paul, thanks for calling. Jerry?
Yeah, there are legends of monsters going back centuries. Of course, Native Americans believed in them. If you've ever seen the rock paintings up on the north shore of Lake Superior, there's a dragon-like creature that they felt was the cause of storms on the lakes. There have also been, rumors about more modern sea creatures more like Nessie, you know. But no evidence of that. They're just the stories that are going around. Mm-hmm. But there were pirates. There were definitely robbers on the lakes back in the sailing days. I've heard many stories about ghost ships that, there's no real evidence, but people love stories like that. One of the enduring legends is of a cache of Confederate gold dollars that were lost in a shipwreck during the Civil War. Apparently, some Union soldiers had stolen it, or either that, or one other version of the legend says that the Confederacy wanted to ship the money up to Canada to try to purchase the services of mercenaries to help them in the battle. In any event, the money, as far as I know, has never been found, if it existed. But again, you're going to get stories like this.
Well, yeah. And yes. I can think of, days when there's fog or a heavy mist on the lake, and somebody might actually see a ship on the lake, and it probably looked like a ghost ship, maybe, you know?
Yeah. You can't tell distances sometimes when the light is a certain way, or when, as you say, when there's fog or mist. What looks like it's far away could be close, or vice versa. Yeah. So, yeah.
Could happen. Paul, thank you for calling. Martha in Menominee will have you join in. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. This is right up my alley. Every November, I tune in. You know, I listen to the stories about Edmund Fitzgerald. I get out the guitar and I run through the song, you know, a few times. But I want to come to the museum up there at Whitefish Bay. We've been planning this like a camping trip for years now, and it looks like we're going to get to go. So I was wondering if Jerry could give me like a tour guide, like a suggested things to do if I come up to the museum, when would be a good time to go, and maybe Jerry could tell me, you know, what kind of things to do up there and what to check out.
Sure. Sure, I've been there many times. It's one of my favorite areas of the Upper Peninsula. If you're camping, you know, a good choice is Tequamanon Falls State Park. The falls are spectacular. You get a good view of them from the hiking trails. The problem is it's very popular, so you need to make reservations. And I would not try to go during the 4th of July weekend. It's impossible. The little town of Paradise on the way up to Whitefish Point on the same road is fun, interesting little place that feels like it's fallen out of time. It doesn't feel any different than it seemed when the first time I saw it, when I was there with my dad when I was a kid back in the probably in about the mid-1960s. It seems the same. There is no real difference that I could tell. And it has a couple motels and a little grocery store and some gift shops. They have a blueberry festival every year. I think that's in August, which is my kids still talk about because the parade was parade, put it that way. So yeah, there's lots to explore up there. There's great the Lake Superior beaches west of Whitefish Point are spectacular. They're some of the most pristine, wide open sandy beaches on all of the Great Lakes.
Martha, thanks for calling. And just to go along with that, we got an email from Steve earlier that I hadn't gotten to yet. And Steve wonders, is there yet established a run of hiking or camping trails around the Great Lakes, especially the U.S.-Canada cooperation with maybe around a full shoreline, the full shoreline of Lake Superior, as I think something he's interested in.
Oh, it's a great idea. It hasn't come to pass yet. The North Country Trail covers a good chunk of the southern shore of Lake Superior in Michigan and Wisconsin. But the Canadian side is pretty rugged up there. There's high rocky bluffs. So if there was a trail, it would have to veer inland for, you know, long stretches. But it would be fantastic if it ever comes to fruition. It would be fantastic.
And Zori had emailed too about two rivers. Point Beach State Park and Neshota Beach Park have a great line of recreation trails, great for biking or camping or shoreline viewing, kayaking in shallow water, swimming in sand beaches, also connected to the Manitowoc Shoreline Trail as well. So beautiful recreation that not enough people know about in Zori's mind.
Yeah, that, you know, that's one of the big changes in the last 20 years. There were very few, relatively speaking, compared to now, there were fewer trails of that sort. There were the Rails to Trails programs, for instance, were just getting started to convert old railroad lines into biking paths. And this is, it's happening all over now. There's links taking place that are taking short stretches of paths and joining up with others with the intention of eventually circling all of the lakes.
You know, we're talking about sand, the beaches and so forth reminded me about sand mining, and you discuss that in the book. For decades, sand around the dunes along the Lake Michigan shoreline have been mined and sold. What were they using the sand for, and what's been the impact?
Yeah, they used it for industrial purposes. A lot of it went to Detroit to use for casting of cast iron parts like engine blocks. The sand had to be, you know, they used sand to surround the molten iron. And they liked this Lake Michigan sand because it's actually the sand left from the ancient ocean millions of years ago. So it's been worn to almost round. A lot of sand in more, you know, newer sand has sharp corners and doesn't work as well for industrial purposes. I would guess it doesn't pour as well, for instance. So, yeah, there's always been a hungry market for it. The effects have been pretty dramatic. I spent a few weeks in Indiana Dunes at the very southern shore of Lake Michigan, and it's a 15-mile stretch of Lake Michigan that's national park, and in the middle of it there's a state park also, but it's all protected dune lands. The biggest dune down there, Old Baldy, is gone. Yeah. they harvested it right down to the almost the water level before the local community got together, said, let's stop this while we can, because this is a priceless natural treasure, these dunes, and we want to protect the rest of them. So they managed to save a good chunk of them. But same thing has happened up along the Michigan shore, the dunes. It's dunes almost continuously from Indiana Dunes up to Sleeping Bear Dunes, where near my house, and then up to the very top of Lake Michigan as well. Especially down in southwest Michigan, that shoreline has been mined a fair amount.
And there are some birds that have been affected. I think it's piping plovers, for example. They're shore birds and become endangered due to the loss of the dune habitat. So is it really regulated? I mean, what people have done is, you know, established parks and so forth to protect it that way.
That's really the only way to ensure that they won't be lost. Local communities will you know, form coalitions and try to sue the companies to halt it, at least until it can be studied. And that's been successful in a couple of cases.
Yeah. Mary in Independence, Wisconsin, has something for us. So let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. There was a question about camping along the Lake Superior or the Great Lakes. And in Minnesota, roughly from Duluth up to the Canadian border is the Superior Hiking Trail. It runs along the Sawtooth Mountain Range there, and it goes in and out of the state parks. you can arrange for pickup and drop off. There's lodges and things along the way.
That sounds fascinating. I didn't know about it. I've spent some time on that shoreline, and it's beautiful. It's one of the prettiest shores of all the Great Lakes. Yeah, it's well worth checking out.
Minnesota Superior Hiking Trail. That sounds great. Mary, thank you very much for calling. Tom in Columbus, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My wife and I kind of discovered the peninsula up into Door County and our beautiful Peninsula State Park and some of the wonderful shoreline up there kind of late in life after the kids were grown and gone and school paid for and all that stuff. We started to venture out a little bit, and we love to go to the along the shoreline. I mean, the Harrington Beach and in those areas, and they're just, it's just phenomenal. We go in November up to Door, and we've been pinched by, we get that first into the second week every year, and we've been pinched by that weather that's turned quickly before, and but we just love how that water can go from a jade green kind of foamy and a little bit choppy to just slate gray, black, and sure, I mean, it's just beautiful. We just love it. So I would encourage anybody to spend some time along our lakes and get your state park sticker and get outside.
Tom, thanks for calling. Jerry, a comment?
Yeah, that brings to mind another misunderstanding about the Great Lakes that I have encountered countless times all over the country, and probably, and you encounter it across the oceans as well, and everywhere in the world, that anybody that is aware of the Great Lakes. This book, by the way, has been translated into Korean, so I'm looking forward to seeing what the Korean readers think. But many people think that the lakes are polluted beyond hope. They remember the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire in 1968 and being, you know, the Johnny Carson show. Johnny Carson got a lot of laughs about that. He called Cleveland the mistake by the lake. And that sticks in people's minds and other things. And, you know, there are a lot of pollution problems, and there are places that are in trouble. But the vast majority of the lakes themselves and of the shoreline are still pretty spectacular, as the caller brings to our attention. The Door County shoreline is wonderful. It is beautiful. And it's not alone. There's thousands of miles of great shoreline still.
And you do address that and talk about that in your book, especially, I think, around Lake Erie and your experiences there. And I just want to go back to the book a minute, because when as you cross through these lakes, we not only learn about your experience in the crossing and what's going on and presently, you do a wonderful job of digging back into the history and really the fascinating history of these of all this. It's really, really remarkable. Sumner, in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sumner.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. So I've spent the last 50 years on Lake Superior, mainly in the Apostle Islands, studying colonial water birds and shorebirds. And in 1974, we found the first nesting piping plover on Long Island. But that's not why I'm calling. I had an unusual experience about 7 years ago, which kind of haunts me to this day. And that is, I was doing a marsh bird survey on Madeline Island at a place called Big Bay Lagoon. And I did this survey. This was a marsh bird, a rail and bittern survey. It was done late at night, starting about 11 o'clock. And when I got done, as I was heading back to the place where I could take my kayak out and walk up to my campsite, I noticed a bright light coming through the pines. And I was amazed. I was thinking, the time now was about, close to 1 a.m. And I was thinking, Who's out at this time of night? Who's walking along the beach? So I decided to investigate and went out I got to the place where I was going to take my kayak out, got out, and I walked toward the pines and got out to the pines, and there, what should I see but a large, crystalline bowl-shaped object, probably about, I would say maybe, I would estimate it was about a quarter mile away, but probably farther, because I was so tired. And probably about 1,000 feet or so above the water. I knew it wasn't the moon because the moon had been a sliver over my right shoulder. And so I just parked myself in the sand and watched this thing. It was like a crystalline bowl-shaped object. It did not move at all. One friend of mine said, well, it was probably a weather balloon, but there was nothing visibly attached to it anywhere. And so I had no explanation for it. A Native American elder friend of mine said, well, remember, consider yourself blessed. You've had a visit with the great spirit of the lake. And that was sort of his explanation of it. But I'm just wondering, have you had any unusual sightings or reports of something similar to that?
No, I've never seen anything like that. And I don't think I've even heard of anything like that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, interesting story, Sumner. Well, maybe somebody else has, and we'll hear from them. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Bob in Lake Nabagamon, we'll go to you next time, Bob.
Afternoon. I tell you, speaking of spiritual things, if you ever kayak the Brule River.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We got two yas.
Well, if you take the final portion, it's about a 2.5 to 3 hour, depending on water level, downstream, which is actually north, is the Brule flows north into Lake Superior. You're paddling along and for 2 or 3 hours, and then all of a sudden you come out on Lake Superior, and it's just it's exhilarating. It's every time I do it, I love it. Fantastic.
Bob, thanks for calling. Have you done that, Jerry?
I have. I've had that experience on many rivers, and I'm the same way. I never get tired of it. It lifts my heart every time to see all this immensity of water. And
Bob, thank you very much for calling. Jerry Dennis, our guest today, his book, The Living Great Lakes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Jerry Dennis, our guest today, Jerry's book, The Living Great Lakes. And if you have a question, excuse me, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's WPR.org. Love to hear from you. The summer before your trip on the Malabar, and you write about this in the book, you did the Chicago to Mackinac sailboat race. What was that like? You describe it well.
Yeah, that's a world I had never entered. I knew nothing about. I was naive enough to think that I could just talk my way onto a boat. You know, who wouldn't be honored to have a writer on board, right? And I just got laughed at. And people, they said, we don't want any dead weight on the boat. Get out of here. And but through a series of really lucky breaks, just pure coincidence, involving a crew member on one of the boats who fell and broke his leg, opening up a spot at the moment that I happened to be there, I got onto a boat and was able to experience this crazy day and night race up the length of Lake Michigan for 3 days and ending at Mackinac Island at 3 a.m. And the whole town was partying, and that's just crazy. It was just a very different experience for me.
And you did another canoe trip, and I'm on Superior. You paddled the big lake in a replica Voyager canoe. And that had to have been a great experience.
And it was.
I liked one of your lines there. I think it was there where you were sitting in the canoe and you said it felt like resting on the back of a sleeping animal.
Mm.
I love that line.
Well, that was a good experience. I had always wanted to do a trip like that because I read so much about the Voyagers and their canoes and the 36-foot-long birch bark canoes. The replica that I was on was fiberglass, but it was, in every other regard, it was a pretty accurate replica. There were 12 of us paddling, and I was amazed at how effortless it was and how fast the boat moves once you get going. And of course, we weren't carrying 2 tons of furs, but it was quite an experience. And we got windbound for a couple of days when a storm hit along the north shore of Superior, and that was spectacular. Just sat and tended a fire and watched the waves come crashing in.
Yeah, it was amazing. And you got into furs. And you told some interesting story about the Hudson Bay Company and all of the sort of the trading back and forth and what transpired with that.
Yeah, it was a huge industry. I had, before researching it for the book, I had no idea how much money was involved. It made millionaires out of the owners, and they mostly lived in the Boston and New York area, built big mansions. The Voyagers themselves were paid a pittance. The trappers, many of whom are Native American, were paid in cheap trade goods, like, you know, glass beads and cheap knives, hatchets, and all this money funneled into the pockets of a few people because there was a trend in Europe for beaver hats. I mean, it was the fashion. You weren't anybody if you didn't have a beaver hat. So the furs were being shipped across to Europe and were gobbled up at very high prices.
Yeah, good. It was an amazing, amazing story to me. And millionaires at that day and age, a million yeah, doesn't seem like as much today, but back then a million was a lot of money. Well, a million still is a lot of money, but it was a real lot of money back then. Let's put it that way. Boy. Treble in Lodi has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Treble.
Hi.
What's Hello. On your mind?
Well, I have a kind of a geographical observation to make for your guest and your listeners. As a young man, I was, I guess, 18 years old. I got a job working in Door County in a little art gallery. And then in the next year, I decided to travel in Canada. And I looked at a map, and liking Door County a lot, I observed that there was this place in Ontario on Lake Huron that looked exactly like, physically, like Door County. It was like a mirror image. And I ended up going there and finding some people and worked in an art gallery there for a couple of years. And it was an amazing place. Called the Bruce Peninsula, and the town was called Tobermory. I'm wondering if your guest has ever been there. There's a beautiful harbor there.
Yes, and it's really interesting that you noticed how similar it was to Door Peninsula, because they're both part of the Niagara Escarpment, the limestone formations that, you know, formed Niagara Falls. Arc over, all around Lake Michigan in a big horseshoe, and they are that outcropping of limestone is responsible for a lot of our rock features. And if you look at a map, the Bruce Peninsula and the Door Peninsula are almost identical. You're absolutely right. They're at almost the exact same latitude. They are about the same length. They even angle into the toward the center of the of Lakes Michigan and Huron at the same angle. It's pretty startling. You're the first person I've heard make that observation. So
that's pretty cool. And mentioning Lake Michigan and Lake Huron in the same sentence, they are the only two Great Lakes to merge, as you point out in your book, to merge freely, and the rest are connected by rivers.
Correct. Yes, that's true. So they're technically one lake, and they do. The water currents go east one day and west the next, and there's this merging of not only the water, but of the creatures that live in it.
Yeah. Helen in Little Chute has something for us. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I have a couple of brief comments. Thank you to the author for writing this book. I absolutely love the Great Lakes and worry about them, but thank you for that. I have 150 feet of shoreline on Lake Superior from my grandfather, and our beach is part of the Canadian Shield, and we have some of the oldest rock formations on Earth. So we have rock hunters continuously on our beach, which sometimes is a little bit of an issue. The next comment is the chief engineer of the Edmund Fitzgerald was a friend of my family's, and Harold had retired the year before the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk, so that was always significant in our family. And the last question, I married my husband and I was in Massachusetts for half my life, and our daughter spent her time on Cape Cod. And when she first got to Lake Superior, she said, "Mama, this is not a lake, it's an ocean."
Well, that's what it looks like, isn't it? Sometimes, Jerry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A friend of mine hosted a party of Japanese tourists who came to Michigan. I think they were there for business reasons, and he volunteered to drive them around. And he took him down to the shore of Lake Michigan at the little town called Empire. And they exclaimed, they couldn't believe how big it was. And they kept, you know, through their translator, kept saying, insisting it was an ocean. And they marched down to the water, put their fingers in it and tasted it. And then they were just amazed. So my friend took him 10 miles up the shoreline to another public beach. They did the same thing. Each time they would go down and taste it because they just found it so hard to believe that this was not an ocean.
That's a great story. Jerry, is the book selling well?
Oh, you know, I'm just delighted with that. You never expect a book to continue to be read 20 years after publication. It just doesn't happen very often. And this book has just been pretty spectacular in that way. It's been a steady, reliable seller.
Well, it's I can see why. I've read it twice. I've enjoyed it. I enjoyed it both times. And Jerry, I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a real treat and pleasure to be able to talk with you again. And I bet that book's going to continue to sell for a long, long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Let's do it again in 20 years.
Let's do it again in 20 years. Jerry Dennis, a freelance writer, public speaker, author, his book, The Living Great Lakes, Searching for the Heart of the Inland Seas. Take a look at it. Great to have him with us. And thank you so much for joining in today. And also a big thanks to our team, our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.